Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting from deep in the Yubla-Faris galaxy, on a small planet called Gekonia, east of the albino hills and south of the raging leucistic river, comes the one, the only Gecko Nation Radio.
Good evening, citizens of Gekonia. I hope everybody's doing good tonight. Tonight is December 17th, 2013. It snowed pretty hard today out in Pennsylvania, but I kind of like it. I want to mention to all you guys that Gecko Nation Radio and Herpentine Radio have teamed up to help promote each other. And Herpentine is basically my inspiration to start my career in radio. And I give a lot of credit to JD and Justin for what they do. They have some of the biggest named guests and some of the most important topics in herpetoculture. And their show is very broad-based as far as what they discuss. And, you know, our show here is a little bit more catered to the gecko community, of course. And we will be branching out into other areas like we do. But Herpentine is very broad-based. So if you guys really want to expand your horizons and learn about different areas of herpetoculture, that is the show to go to. And there's other great radio shows as well. So definitely look into it. Blog Talk Radio is a terrific forum for radio. If you have aspirations of basically broadcasting your voice and making something out of it, by all means, do it. It's a lot of fun. I'd also like to wish Sean from Heavy Duty Reptiles happy birthday today. Happy birthday, Sean. Tonight's episode is special. All right, this is a roundtable discussion. It's all about breeding and incubation. And in addition to our great sponsors, this show is also has a special product placement and definitely one of the best rack building and incubator companies around, if not the very best, and that is Sea Serpents and Hot Box Incubators. Now, for this episode, Chris at Sea Serpents and Hot Box graciously is giving a discount, a special discount, to anyone that mentions Gecko Nation Radio from now until Sunday, this upcoming Sunday the 22nd. Okay, and in order to get your discount on a rack or an incubator, you have to email Chris and just mention Gecko Nation Radio, and he will give you a discount on your order. The discount will be different depending on which products you're going to get. Or you're interested in, because there's just a very broad base of products and prices, okay? So keep that in mind. Very proud to have Sea Serpents and Hot Box Incubator sponsor this special episode. And speaking of sponsors, this show would not be possible without our great sponsors. Check them out.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David's Fine Geckos creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. Gecko Nation Radio is sponsored by ABDragons.com, is your source for the highest quality dubia roaches. Whether you're starting a colony of your own or just need feeders for your insect-eating herps, ABDragons.com can't be beat in quality or price. They are also a huge distributor of FlexWatt reptile heat tape and have very competitive pricing. Check out abdragons.com online and on Facebook. Razor Sharp Reptiles. Like the name suggests, Jamie Carnes has some sharp gecko and snake projects in the works. He is very well known for his work with rare species, such as cave geckos, but also has some of the prettiest radar projects I've ever seen. Razor Sharp Reptiles is also known for high-end fantails and beautiful rainwater leopard gecko morph projects. Check out RazorSharpReptiles.com online and on Facebook. Dale's Bearded Dragons is your one-stop source for any reptile supply products that you may need, from Exoterra, Zoomed, Rapashi, Repcal, Fluker, and much, much more, and all at 20 to 50% cheaper than your local pet store or big chain pet store. They are also the biggest reptile supply distributor at most of the Northeast Expos. contact them directly online at dalesbeardeddragons.com or message me on Facebook and I'll put you in touch with the owner. And if you're looking for quality food for your dubia roaches, crickets, mealworms, and superworms, look no further than MS2 Premium Insect Chow. Made with reptiles in mind, it contains no dog food, cat food, or chicken mash. Using only vegetable proteins and high-quality ingredients, MS2 Premium Insect Chow will have your feeders making a beeline for it. Contact mstent.weebly.com, or it can also be purchased at Rainbow Mealworms and AB Dragons. Gecko Boa Reptiles is your source for the highest quality leopard gecko morphs and wild types, from white and yellows to radars, amazing tremper morphs, and rare subspecies. John is a world-class breeder and extremely knowledgeable. If you're looking for something truly special in geckos, contact John Scarborough at geckoboa.com and on Facebook.
Okay, everybody. Something that's new that's going on with Gecko Nation Radio is we picked up a new sponsor, Rainbow Mealworms. You guys can check out rainbowmealworms.net online. There's a couple other ones that are trying to copy off of them. Make sure you go to rainbowmealworms.net. That's the right one. They are the biggest worm farm in the country out in California. And most of us big, excuse me, most of us big breeders exclusively use Rainbow. I know Ron Tremper does. In fact, Ron is the one that turned me on to Rainbow. And definitely check them out, rainbowmealworms.net. Now, as you guys know, Gecko Nation Radio is also the official radio show associated with Gecko Forums. So check this thing out. Wrong plug.
Did you know that since 2006, there's been a treasure trove of history and information on leopard geckos and other species? Well, Gecko Forums is the most extensive database of leopard gecko history on the web right now. Take a look and delve into the past, present, and future of this great community. The biggest contributors, breeders, and hobbyists have left their mark there. Now it's your turn. Look, learn, and post away. Need a place to post animals for sale? Look no further. Visit geckoforums.net and become a member today. Gecko Nation Radio is proud to be the official radio show associated with Gecko Forums.
All right, everybody. Tonight's show, I'm going to structure as best as I can, and we're going to start at the very beginning. I'm going to basically ask each one of our guests specific questions so that we can basically get a good grasp of how to do a step-by-step process as far as breeding and incubation goes. So basically, my first question is going to be directed at one of our guests, and it's going to be, what is the best age and weight to start breeding your Leos at? And then we're going to go from there. If we have time in the second half of the show, we will certainly take your, and the call-in number for that is 646-478-5331. Again, it's 646-478-5331. Tonight's distinguished guests are John Scarborough from GeckoBoa.com, Matt Veronik from Sassabeck Reptiles, and, of course, Marcia McGinnis from Golden Gate Geckos. I'm going to go ahead and bring on our guests. Let's start with Marcia. Hey, Marcia, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, it's great to have you. I'm doing good, Marcia.
Good.
For people that don't
be here.
For people that don't know who you are, just quickly do a quick little recap of who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm Marcia McGinnis, and I own Golden Gate Geckos. I've been working with geckos since breeding geckos actually since 1995, and I currently work with seven species of geckos, and I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Awesome. All right, I'm going to go ahead and bring on John now. John Scarborough, you're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hey guys, how you doing, man?
Good, John. Tell us a little bit about yourself real quick.
My name is John Scarborough. I own and operate Gecko Boa Reptiles. I'm based out of Colorado. I mainly specialize in leopard geckos, wild types, and morphs. I do work with some boa constrictors, a few monitor species, and a few other species of geckos. You can check out my website at geckoboa.com.
awesome. And last but not least, we have Matt Baronic. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hey, guys. What's up? How's it going?
Good. Who are you, Matt? What do you do?
Good. Well, I'm also a leopard gecko breeder.
Really?
Yeah. I own and operate Fastback Reptiles. Been doing this for a few years now, and just newly moved to Connecticut is where I'm based out of now.
Cool. All right. Now, tonight's show, as you guys know, is the roundtable discussion about breeding and incubation. I think a good place to start, and I'm going to try to, so we don't stumble and talk all over each other, I'm going to direct each question at one of you, and then after you answer the question, I'll ask the other two if they have anything they'd like to add to it. So this way we're not talking over each other or anything. So ladies first, Marcia, what is the best age, and quiet children, please, what is the best age and weight for breeding males and females, Marcia?
Well, in the olden days, we used to say 36 to 38 grams in 6 months for females was okay, and it just isn't. So I think over time, the more we've learned and the more we've worked with them, that there's no real magic number as far as an age or weight goes, but I try to keep it to at least a year old minimum for females. 50 grams in weight. It would be better to have a 60-gram female breeding. Now, for males, it's a little bit less. I've got males that can reach, 45 to 50 grams by the time they're 6 months old, and they can be, sexually active at that point. I don't know that I would put them through the stress of that, but I think males probably 9 months. At least 50 grams is what I do. That's what I strive for.
Okay. John, do you have anything you'd like to add to that? And then we'll go to Matt.
I think it's just a combination of things. It's not necessarily a weight. I breed my Afghans. I bred females as low as 33, 35 grams.
Hold on
last
one second,
year.
John. Just, if anybody's making noise, just hit the mute button so it's not on the radio because the speakers are very sensitive, and we're hearing a lot of background noise. Go ahead, Matt. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No worries. I think it depends sometimes on the genetics of the animal. If you're talking, say, wild types, an Afghan female can, breed and lay eggs perfectly fine at 33. I had some at, 33, 35 grams last year that bred fine for me. No egg binding at all, no problems. For instance, if you're talking Angamaniu, that would, we're looking at 2 to 3 years and at least 70, 80 grams before a female will lay eggs. So there can be a very big difference just depending on the genetics of the animal. For most macularis, a safe bet is usually above 50 grams is what, most people say for the most part. And then, if you go much lower than that, you can kind of risk egg binding. But, it depends on the age of the animal and also the weight. So some people can get a gecko to heavy weights really young, and that doesn't mean you should breed it that young. So I'm all about slow growing my animals and keeping them, I basically want them to reach about 45, grams at like 10 months or something like that, 9 to 10 months. And that way they hit the weight at about the same time as that they're mature at the same time. So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we basically got some of the aspects are you guys kind of agree on. What do you think, Matt? What do you have in your experience to add?
I definitely agree with John that it definitely is pretty much determined about, by the genetics of the animal. Some animals just don't get as big. Some get, much larger. So having a generic, 50-gram thing is really hard to tell the general public. It definitely has to do with genetics and how, big the animal is predisposed to be getting. And that all just depends on, like John said, on the genetics and you know, just knowing your animals and knowing how big the animal should be before it can safely be bred.
Okay, and I think Marsha's advice is sound as far as if you're a new breeder and you basically don't know how to determine, you know, what your, you know, basically how good your geckos are going to breed at a certain age or size, I think a good rule of thumb is to wait a year, wait till they're about a year old, and, you know, play it safe. I think as you become more experienced and you get to know your geckos and you get to know breeding, I think you'll be able to make more different determinations based on a case, you know, on a case-to-case basis with your animals. But, yeah, I think I agree with all you guys. Now, I'm sure one of the questions somebody's going to ask is, now, are these ages and sizes different when it comes to giants? And I know, Matt, you don't work too much with giants. I know, John, you do. And I'm not sure about Marsha. I don't think you do either. But why don't we start with John
with
this?
I only have a couple of giants, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, John, you have some experience with giants. I'll give this one to you first. Do you think there's any difference when it comes to size and age with giants as far as breeding them?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think giants do grow slower, or they grow for a longer period of time. So they can reach bigger weights at a quicker, in a less time or a smaller time frame, but they do take longer to get to that age. So if I have a giant that hatched late in the season, I won't even try to breed it the next year. I'll actually wait 2 years to breed it, which is kind of interesting because it's kind of the same thing with, like, Angermanis. They say that, you know, they don't – well, I've never had one, or I've never seen one breed under 2 years. So they say 2 to 3 years with that. And I'm sure Matt can vouch for that too, because he has some animals that, you know, that are a year old that didn't breed this last year. So it kind of goes with that same thing, that these geckos will grow for a longer period of time if their maximum size gets larger. But I have bred giants in the first year. Usually it's like giants that were hatched earlier in the season, and then, you know, they had maybe like 15 months to grow or so. I have bred them at that time. A lot of people think that stunts their growth. I think it stunts their growth for at least a short period of time. But after that, they can start growing again later on. So I think over 2 or 3 years, they'll still reach a larger size, you know. But when they are actually breeding, most geckos go off food anyway for that period of time, at least to start off with. And so they will slow down on growth. But yeah, the giants, I would definitely say you'll probably notice it too when you're breeding, that, you know, if the gecko is 5 months old and 60 grams, you shouldn't be breeding it anyway. It's too young. And so, if you know, if it's 9, 10 months old and it gets up to 80 and then it ovulates at that time, then you probably are okay to breed it at that time. I mean, I'm a big believer, actually, that giants are recessive anyway, but, you know, as far as that goes, I think they're, for the most part, they're the same as normal leopard geckos, but the ones that actually get bigger, I think they do take a longer period of time to breed.
Okay. Do any of you guys have anything to add to that about the giants? Matt or Marsha?
I've actually seen giant females that were bred early, and they actually gained even more weight during the breeding season, which, you know, that's kind of an abnormality, but I've actually seen a 90-gram female that she was 90 grams whenever she first started breeding, and at the end of the season, she was 120.
Wow.
which is, you know, like, that's definitely not the norm. And like John said, I think if you're looking to see how big your animal can get before you breed it, then, you know, that's, you would definitely want to wait that year to 2 year mark, just to see how big the female would get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you breed a male too early, they run the risk of a prolapse, from what, you know, I understand. Now, if that should happen, that's a pretty bad thing. Would one of you like to discuss a little bit what a prolapse is? I think Marsha's a good one to handle this.
Sure.
Marsha, why don't you tell us, Why don't you tell us about what a male prolapse is and how it can affect things?
Yeah, they can be pretty. They can be serious, but they it's serious something you don't want to have to deal with it if you can help it. But essentially, the male's reproductive organ, which is called the hemipenis, is a two-lobed organ. So because they breed from the side, there's one on each side. And they stay neatly tucked away most of the time, just at the underneath the base of the tail. But then during breeding, one will evert. And that means it comes out and they line up the cloaca. Their cloaca is the male and female, and then that's where breeding occurs and copulation and then the sperm transfer. But there is a lot of reasons why a hemipenis may not invert, which means go back into where it's supposed to go. One reason is injury. The other reason is I think sometimes males can be if they're really overweight and there's a lot of fat deposits around their vent area, that can also, you know, contribute to hemipenile prolapse. Males that are too young can too. I've experienced several incidences of prolapse, you know, in the last 17 or 18 years, and only one of them, only in one incident, I was not able to resolve it myself, and it required surgery.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, what about you, Matt or John? Do you guys like to add to that?
I've only ever had four males that have prolapsed. And on two of them, they lost the hemipene on that side, but were still able to breed using the other side. One prolapsed both hemipenes. They were both out for close to a month, and I actually, you know, had to, you know, keep them on a moist paper towel and, you know, apply, you know, topical ointment to him. And, you know, finally they went back in on their own. The other one, and basically I put him on the shelf for you know, that whole year and didn't breed him again. I'll actually try to breed him this year to see if he's able to breed or not. The other one, actually, he prolapsed one side of his hemipene that was out for about a week. I was able to put it back in. I gave him about a two-week rest and actually, you know, to see if he actually could breed again. I tried breeding him again, and he actually bred with no problem and was able to put the hemipene back in. So, you know, it's and actually none of these animals were young animals. They were all over a year of age. Most of them were, a couple of them were actually like 3 or 4 years of age whenever it happened. Whenever I have seen it, it has been usually the beginning of the breeding season. Sometimes the females aren't quite as receptive whenever the male's breeding. I think that's basically what had happened on, you know, most of those cases was, you know, maybe the female pulled away a little bit too soon and kind of, you know, maybe stretched the male a little bit where he was unable to put everything back to where it goes. But, you know, as far as it being a devastating injury, I think the only way that really happens is if it goes untreated and it becomes infected or anything like that, or if the male loses both hemipenes. I've actually seen it in knob-tailed geckos as well, where an animal has lost, one hemipene on the one side and was still able to breed. And, you know, still, you know, a viable father. I've also seen it, I've heard of it in ball pythons and stuff like that. That's pretty much why they have two, is just in case, you know, something happens to one, they're still okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good information. I hope you guys out there never have to experience something like that, because it is difficult. to, you know.
Can I add one more thing to that, too?
Absolutely, Marcia. Go ahead,
well,
please.
I forgot another contributing reason, and listening to Matt kind of reminded me that a male might experience a hemipenile prolapse, and that is sperm plugs. So what sometimes happens, especially with younger males, they're always very excited about breeding season, especially if there's pheromones in the air and they know that there is ovulating females. So sometimes ejaculation takes place before the hemipenis is completely out or in copulation, and semen can kind of leak out into the pocket where the hemipenis pouch, where it's stored safely. And sometimes it can get kind of hard, and I don't mean hard. It gets kind of rubbery, if you will, or semi-solid in there.
Congeals.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for the word. That's good. That's what I was looking for. a lot of times the hemipenis can come out, but with a lot of that residue, and my vet calls it smegma, that's inside the pocket, will prevent the hemipenis from inverting or from going back where it belongs. So sometimes those need to be taken care of. I know how to get rid of sperm plugs, but I've been doing this for a long time too, so it's not something I would recommend for just anybody. So sometimes veterinary interference is protocol.
Yeah, I've had that happen where I had I noticed that one of my males, one of his bulges was getting way bigger than the other, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And then finally, it kind of started showing itself through his cloaca there, and it was what you're calling a sperm plug. So basically, I took some, I think I used organic olive oil just to lubricate the area, and then with tweezers, I was able to actually pull the plug out.
Yeah.
And yeah, he was no worse for wear afterwards. He seemed fine, and
right.
He was fine that season. Yeah. So
occasionally that will turn into almost like an internal cyst or some kind of growth that becomes encapsulated in tissue, there's a blood supply around it, so you have to be kind of careful. But in most cases, sperm plugs are not that complicated to remove yourself. If you don't feel like you can handle it, take them to a vet, that's for sure.
Yeah, okay. And I would think the next step in our discussion here would be, all right, now that we've figured out what the best age and sizes are and give you guys an idea how to handle that, I think the next step would be to determine when the breeding season is. I get a lot of questions about, hey, Dave, when does the breeding season start? And, it can really be different based on your area. I'll give this one to Matt first. What do you think, Matt? When do females start ovulating? When does the season start?
I've had females start anywhere from, like, as early as, like, October sometimes, depending on the females. I definitely have a couple groups of females that they actually breed much earlier than everybody else. And I know a lot of people will say, well, October is kind of, the previous year. But it's one of those things that they're actually a little bit older females, and they've went a month early every year of their life, basically. So they did actually start off in the right year at one point, and then they go about a month earlier every year. I also have other animals that that they'll definitely go a little bit later. Usually first year females will go a little bit later just because they're not quite old enough yet. So I would say the best thing to do for starting to look for ovulations is you want to start looking between like December, January, February, and then breeding will usually take place about 2 weeks after you start seeing it in the room. You'll notice that they'll want to breed a little bit easier after about 2 weeks.
Okay. John, would you like to add to that?
For me, I
at this point, I have a female pretty much ovulating all year round, so you're always going to have those oddballs that kind of ovulate in the off season. But for me, myself, most of my females go around June, July. My season's pretty late, so like this year, I had maybe 50% of my geckos actually hatched in August this year, so everything's on a later schedule for me. And I mean, I don't know if that's just due to my location or maybe barometric pressure or whatever it is. It's just everything usually goes later here. But yeah, I usually get a few females. Like I got like one or two females right now that are ovulating that I'm breeding. And then January it starts maybe 3 or 4, and then after that it starts picking up all the way till usually June, almost everything is ovulating in my whole room, so or at least laying eggs or ovulating at that time. So
interesting.
Want to add one other thing to the prolapse that you were talking about earlier too. It's just I probably had 8 or 9 prolapses over the years, and if you ever get this problem, I mean, I learned this from Steve Sykes, which I think if anybody has experience with this, it would probably be him. And whenever I get this situation, I just soak the male, like, under some warm water for maybe 30 to 45 minutes. I always check the males whenever they come out of the female's tub, and I check to see if they have a prolapse at that time. It's a good point to check. That way you catch it early as possible. If they have a prolapse at that time, I'll actually throw them into a tub, only the tub with maybe like a half inch of warm water, just enough to like keep, continually soaking their gunk down there. And after 45 minutes, I take them out, and then I throw them into a tub with really sopping, soaking wet paper towels. And I've never had to go to the vet for this. It's every instance, it's healed itself. Even if I caught it late, it pretty much heals itself in the situation. So if you throw it into a sopping a tub with paper towels, really, really wet, that way it's pretty much soaked the whole time. And usually it'll go in within a day or two. Sometimes it's taken 3 to 4 days, but every time it's gone in perfectly fine. And just make sure you keep it very clean. If they poop, just like immediately clean it out, because you don't want that water, creating any other issues.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Very good point.
So literally every other day, at least clean it out, change all the paper towels, completely spray it out, clean it. And I've never had one that, required the vet. I thought I was going to, but, I reached out to Steve Sykes about that, because he pretty much has more experience than anybody I know, at least, that with that. Maybe Ron Trimper, too, but, I think it really was good information. I used to do the whole sugar water, and I do the, preparation H, the whole idea behind that is to get that hemipene, the swelling, to go down. But I think just soaking water and just the moist paper towels always works, I mean, I had 3 last year, and every one worked perfectly fine. And they were, in within a couple of days. I waited a couple of months, and I rebred them, and everything went fine. So, sorry to get off on the tangent again, but thought it was
important. That's okay. We'll go back to the breeding season. I'll add that my season here usually starts the end of December and into January, but it seems like it's getting a little earlier each year. Every year it gets to be like 3 weeks earlier for some reason. Like, I have females starting to ovulate now, and they're setting other females off because the pheromones are flowing. And I know, Marcia, your season starts, what, in March or February?
Yeah. Am I on mute?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. No, I'm sorry. My season starts pretty late. And it ends a little earlier than most too. So, but I have found that once, like John said too, once one or two females start ovulation, the rest of them will too. So it's kind of a phenomenon that we find in populations of female species, even in human beings. I mean, for example, women in or young women in you know, that are institutionalized, either, you know, let's say that they're in jail or if they're in a boarding school or things like that, for any length of time, they'll eventually, you know, start their, they'll do their menstruation cycle, you know, pretty much together at the same time every 28 days. So I think that that really contributes to it. But the other thing is, I don't, I know that there are some breeders who are much larger scale, that will actually manipulate the, you know, the light and temperature cycle in order to have females, you know, ready to breed and egging year round. I don't do that because I need a break, you know, but they pretty much cycle themselves when right after Thanksgiving, or excuse me, right after the autumn equinox. They, when the nights start getting longer than the days, they'll stop ovulation, and then sometime after, you know, the holidays, once the daytime becomes, the daytime hours become markedly longer than the nighttime hours, that's usually what triggers ovulation in my geckos. So mm-hmm. I just let them cycle themselves. But there's always an oddball here and there that, you know, that starts early or late, and that's okay.
Yeah. I'll give this one to Matt. Hey, Matt, how long does a female ovulate for? And after that, well, yeah, let's just stick with that for now. How long will a female usually ovulate for once she starts? And can she ovulate more than once in a season?
Let's go with, I've actually not put a male in for like up to 2 to 3 weeks after I noticed an ovulation. Just because mm-hmm. males were getting rotated around and stuff like that, and you know, she was the female was still able to breed and you know, produce viable young. But I mean, I kind of do something that's, you know, a little bit different than most people, where once I start getting good eggs from a female, you know, that's pretty much the last time the male goes in. I don't like to, you know, crank my females, like make them produce, you know, 15, 20, you know, eggs. Most of my females will average about eight eggs I'll get out of them. That's, you know, not all of them are fertile all the time, but usually I'll get, you know, four clutches, sometimes five. And that's pretty much average for me. You know, that being said, that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm getting 10 babies out of each female either, because they're, you got to account for infertility and stuff like that as well. But, you know, as far as will a female, like, you know, double ovulate in a season, typically not, unless you're, you know, trying to make her do that. If she is, you know, just set up normally in a tub and you're not manipulating anything with, like, the light and temperature, she won't do that. Usually once you miss the ovulations for the year, it's pretty much over. But that being said, you know, the first ovulation, she can, you can definitely take your time to put the male in, because usually what I do is, like I said, once I notice it for the first time, I'll even wait about a week before I actually put the male in. Just to make sure that the ovulations are, you know, bigger in size and, you know, that the female is more highly receptive towards the male.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. John, would you like to add to that?
Whenever I see an ovulation, I just pretty much will throw the male in. I think any time during that time, there's, you know, a good chance that they're going to be receptive. And, you know, the females will retain the sperm anyway, even if it maybe it's a little early or a little late. For the most part, it'll, you know, it'll work out. I had a few geckos last year. I think I was waiting on a rack order, so I didn't breed them, like, right when the ovulation happened. I think I waited about a month, and they were still ovulating when I threw a male in, but I didn't get any eggs out of them. So I think if you wait if you wait too long, even if they're still ovulating, you could lose out on that season for that female. So,
yeah.
Only other times I've seen double ovulations in a year, I've seen it where, like, a female ovulated, I threw a male in and nothing happened. Like, there were no eggs, and she just, you know, ovulations went away, and I just thought that was it. And then, you know, a couple months later, all of a sudden she was gone again. So that's the only time I've really seen it double in a year.
Well, can I interject again?
Absolutely, yeah, Marcia. You're right. Next anyway.
Well, oh, good. I didn't want to take cuts or anything. You know, leopard geckos actually ovulate continually through breeding season. So in other words, there's not a single ovulation. So when Matt and John were both talking about ovulations as a plural, that is accurate, because once breeding season begins, the female will produce a follicle or an egg in situ, or an egg that's developing off of the ovary. And so in best case scenario, if you're a good healthy female, I mean, they can ovulate two egg follicles every 2 weeks, every 14 days.
But if she's not fertilized, it'll just stop after like 3 weeks to a month, perhaps, right?
What, the ovulations? Yes and no. Sometimes it can just stop, and other times, generally speaking, the eggs are looking to be fertilized so that they can develop into eggs in the oviducts. And so if they're not fertilized, they degenerate and, you know, disintegrate and are reabsorbed back into the female system. Now, sometimes that does not happen, and the ovum or the large egg, you know, the follicles have already produced an ovum, and if they're not if they're not fertilized or absorbed back into the female's body, then that can cause some problems with the female in terms of an infection, or sometimes those unfertilized ovum become infertile eggs, and they actually develop and are passed through just like fertile eggs are, but they're not fertile at all. So, you know, so it takes a trained eye to learn to see the egg follicles that are developing through a female leopard gecko's abdomen. But I have seen cases where a female has got a good sized pair of ovum, or that are probably, in most cases they're fertilized, and then they will be developing another set right behind them. So there are times that you can see multiple, sometimes four, two complete sets of ovum that are produced from the ovary. So I've had females lay eggs every 14 days for the entire breeding season, and other females that, you know, will only lay maybe one or two, three at the most clutches. And if they're still, you know, healthy, then I can reintroduce them to the male to start getting more eggs, more fertile eggs. But it's a science. I mean, it's something that you definitely need to learn, and it is learnable. And each female is a little bit different, and some are very robust, and some just have a hard time recovering between clutches of eggs, so they're not necessarily good candidates to rebreed. But yeah, so to clear up the questions about what is ovulation. Ovulation is when their two ovaries produce a follicle, which is an undeveloped egg or an undeveloped ovum, which is the cell that produces the egg. And it breaks off as it's mature and goes into the oviduct waiting to be fertilized. And if it's not fertilized, it usually just dissolves and is absorbed back into the female system, on rare occasions, it can develop into an egg that gets passed that is infertile. So that's how it works.
Gotcha. All right. Well, that's understood. All right. So we have our ovulating female, and we know it's the breeding season. She's up to the right weight. She's got the right age to where we're confident that she's a healthy female. And I think something that is important to know, we can just touch on, I think it's more or less common sense at this point, is the fact that up until now, the female should have been supplemented properly with vitamins and calcium. I guess we can touch on this real quick. When you're getting your females ready for breeding, and I'll start with John with this one. How do you supplement and get them the right calcium? What's your regimen, John, for that?
Pretty much for all my breeders and pretty much all my adult leopard geckos and even my babies as well. I don't use like an extra calcium dish ever. I use those mealworm dishes and those superworm dishes that have the little plastic lid on top that keeps the worms from escaping. But I basically put a lot of worms or dubio, whatever I'm feeding to the gecko, and I use calcium and vitamin powder on top, and I mix it in pretty well. I do throw a little bit extra when there's females that are laying eggs, just so they have that always there. But, you know, that food dish actually doubles as the feeder dish and as the calcium dish. So they can always go in there and get extra calcium when they need it. I don't think I've ever had an issue of over-supplementing the geckos, especially with the worms. You know, the worms, they usually shed the calcium or whatever you dusted them with pretty quickly. Even the other feeders, they typically clean themselves to an extent that, you know, you don't really have to worry about that too much. I use a mixture of vionate to calcium, about 4 to 1. And for calcium, I use Osteoform FA, and I use that with a 50-50 mixture with RepCal calcium. I've used straight Osteoform before. I haven't really had a big issue with the phosphorus ratio, in my opinion. But if you buy RepCal in bulk, like the really big bulk tub, it's actually a little cheaper than buying Osteoform FA. So I just mix it in half anyway, and you know, it does cut down the phosphorus ratio, if that's really an issue, but I haven't actually seen that in my collection. But
okay. How about you, Matt? You want to talk about your regimen?
They just get the normal, just like John does, only I just use straight-up Osteoform SA and Viamate. It's about a 4-to-1 mixture, I think. What I've been doing recently is just doing the 10-pound tub and then one of the containers of Osteoform SA. It just makes it easier than measuring everything out. And I've been using that for years with no issues. So it's one of those things that, you know, it would take a lot for me to switch to anything else.
Okay, how about you, Marsha?
Okay, am I still on?
You're on.
You can't hear me, right? Oh, okay. You know, I can't remember when I pushed the mute button or not. So,
who's making all the noise in the background? That's what I want to know.
Well, it's not me. I'm just sitting here minding my own business.
I'm sitting here watching hockey. So.
I don't want you yelling at me or anything, David.
I'm not yelling at anybody.
I'm trying to eat dinner at the same time, so sorry.
Whoever it is, we can hear everything you're doing. But go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Marcia.
Okay, so the question is, what is my supplementation regime?
Yep.
Okay,
yes,
well, I
have your females and your males ready.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, everybody gets calcium without vitamin D year-round every time their bowl of mealworms gets replaced or topped off. Now, I will switch to calcium with vitamin D for egging and laying females and growing babies because I've like John, I've never experienced any, hypervitaminosis D or anything like that, in all these years. But I think that the D actually helps with the absorption of, the calcium into the bloodstream. And I don't think adult males necessarily need vitamin D supplementation very often. Especially if you're using Dubia roaches or it basically just depends on what kind of feeders you're using. If you're using worms of any kind, people have to understand that these worms are larvae. They don't really gut load, like an adult insect will, an adult dubia, something that's already fully developed. I'm not saying it doesn't matter with mealworms, but it's not as critical as it is for proper supplementation of your live feeders that carry on whatever they've got stored up in their system. That's why it's called gut loading to the gecko. But I have used RepCal products for about 15 years, and I switched recently to another product, and I had good results for the first year or two, and then something happened, and this year wasn't that great. I think we've kind of narrowed it down to getting a bad batch of product. But I did speak with Dr. Daniel Wentz, W-E-N-T-Z, and he is the formulating chemist for RepCal products, which is actually local here in the south area of the San Francisco Bay. And I was picking his brain one time, and I was flapping my arms and my mouth and saying, look, I don't understand how there can be a one-size-fits-all supplementation for every reptile. It just doesn't work that way. Bearded dragons and iguanas need to assimilate vitamin D through their skin, where nocturnal species like, the Aussie geckos and leopard geckos don't. And so what's up with that? And basically what he told me is, and it was kind of, I shouldn't be name dropping, but that's okay. But he just said, look, I really am supposed to tell you that RepCal products are superior to all the other products because I'm their their chief formulating chemist. And so, I'm supposed to tell you that. He says, but in reality, we don't really know what proper supplementation is for species to species. He said, so... he just said that nocturnal species probably need vitamin D, where diurnal species that have the proper, light wavelengths, the multi-spectrum wavelengths to help them assimilate vitamin D through their skin, don't necessarily need vitamin D. He says, but it's more how the animal metabolizes it. So yep. the example he gave me is, okay, all of us have had dogs or cats where we've switched food. You got a dog and your vet tells you it needs to go on a different diet. We all know what happens, especially with cats, if we just automatically switch their food. Well, they get upset stomach, they get gas, they get diarrhea. It takes a while before their body starts to actually assimilate properly that new food. He said, so the same thing would apply for any kind of supplementation for a reptile, that if you are going to switch, if it's broke, don't fix it, but if you are going to switch, then you want to mix 50-50, for example, of the supplement that they've been on with half of the new one, and eventually wean them off of it and get them back on to, the newer the product that you're going to be using, so that their body has a chance to learn how to process it and assimilate it. So I'm going back to RepCal products again because they are expensive, but I don't have quite the inventory of animals that I used to have, so I think it's going to be my best bet back again. So.
Okay, I agree with you, Marcia. Well, and I agree with everybody. Whatever your product of choice is, go for it. I like the Repcal. I've been using Repcal since I'm a kid, and I'm kind of just like I'm just attached to it. And I haven't. It's not like I haven't tried anything else. I really haven't incorporated anything else into my regimen, and just I don't know. I had great success. My geckos speak for themselves, and I've just been doing really well with them. But okay, so now that we have the basics down, we have our geckos. They're fat. They're not fat. They're healthy. They're up to weight. They're up to size. They're ready for breeding. Now the questions that I get, and I'm sure you guys get them too. How do you, when your females are ovulating, what's the best way to get your breeding going? Now, is it better to introduce the male to the female's tub or the female's tank, or is it better to introduce the female to the males? And I'll give this one to John first. Go ahead, John. What do you think?
I think it's always best to introduce the male to the female. And I think most will agree on that. For the most part, females, if the mating isn't successful, it's usually because of the female. Usually they're not receptive. The males are kind of always ready to breed, so they don't really have a problem. So it's usually the females. And I always find it best to not introduce a female to a male's territory because she's going to be even more uncomfortable at that time. It's better to put the male in with the female. And I think most breeders do that. But, I mean, you can have success either way. But that's typically how it goes from what I understand.
Okay. What are your thoughts, Matt?
I always go males get switched to females' cages.
Okay. Do you guys ever... go ahead, Marcia, and then I'll ask my next question. What do you usually do, Marcia?
Well, I think it depends. Sometimes it just doesn't work out that way, but the majority of the time I do introduce the male to the female into her habitat because she feels comfortable there. If it's done the other way around, sometimes she's going to be overly intimidated in a new habitat, new smells, even though they're all set up the same. And then she's the permission giver, basically. she's the one that's going to give permission on whether or not, breeding or copulation occurs. And so I think it helps to have the female on her own turf and then introduce the male because he's only going to be, he's only going to be looking for one thing. That's it. He's not going to care if their smells are different because it smells good. And it just works out the best that way for me. To introduce the male mm-hmm. into the female's habitat.
Okay. All right. That's cool. Okay. Well, my next question was going to be along that thread, but all right. So say for instance you have a group of three females and one of them is ovulating, but the other two aren't, and you'd like to make sure that one female is fertilized by a male, but you don't want to introduce the male to that tub because what if the male starts going after the females that aren't ovulating? So in that kind of an instance, is it okay to introduce the female into the male tub and just remove and put her back with the other females the next day?
Is this pointed towards anybody?
I'll give it to you, Marcia, first, and then the guys can go.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's okay to do that. But you got to keep in mind too that males are very persistent during breeding season, and the females that are not receptive can beat him up. I mean, they will just they can actually cause injury if the male will just pretty much focus on the female that is ovulating, because housing animals like that in groups, which I used to do and I still do, like with my bandids and other species that are mammalii, but. Yeah, sure, that's okay. That's okay, but another option would be just to set up another temporary breeding tub or something to put them both in so they're both starting out on neutral ground.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you guys think? Matt, what do you think about that?
In most of my groups of females, both females are always ovulating, so together. Usually once one smells it, the other one starts ovulating as well. So I've never really had a problem with that. I always move the male to the female. I never put the female in the male cage. He usually has a bachelor pad and stuff set up for that kind of thing. So I usually move the male to the much prettier interior of the female.
Okay. What about you, John?
Yeah, I mean it's pretty much the same. If you have a group of females and one female's ovulating and the others aren't, I would say either remove that female or you can throw the male in. I mean, for the most part, they'll be fine, or the other females will start ovulating too if they're up to size and everything as well. I think in a group setting, I don't see as many problems as with the fighting, especially in a larger tub like a 32 quart like that. So I think it's fine to throw them in either way. I mean, I've done it a few times and it's never had a problem with it.
Okay. So you have your female. Okay, wait a second. We're at the halfway point. Let me take a quick break, and we'll continue our discussion when we get right back. All right, everybody, hang tight.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David's Fine Geckos creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. Gecko Nation Radio is sponsored by Dale's Bearded Dragons is your one-stop source for any reptile supply products that you may need, from Exoterra, Zoomed, Rapashi, Repcal, Fluker, and much, much more, and all at 20 to 50% cheaper than your local pet store or big chain pet store. They are also the biggest reptile supply distributor at most of the Northeast Expos. Contact them directly online at dalesbeardeddragons.com. Or message me on Facebook and I'll put you in touch with the owner. Gecko Boa Reptiles is your source for the highest quality leopard gecko morphs and wild types, from white and yellows to radars, amazing tremper morphs, and rare subspecies. John is a world-class breeder and extremely knowledgeable. If you're looking for something truly special in geckos, contact John Scarborough at geckoboa.com and on Facebook. abdragons.com is your source for the highest quality dubia roaches. Whether you're starting a colony of your own or just need feeders for your insect-eating herps, abdragons.com can't be beat in quality or price. They are also a huge distributor of FlexWatt reptile heat tape and have very competitive pricing. Check out abdragons.com online and on Facebook. Razor Sharp Reptiles. Like the name suggests, Jamie Carnes has some sharp gecko and snake projects in the works. He is very well known for his work with rare species, such as cave geckos, but also has some of the prettiest radar projects I've ever seen. Razor Sharp Reptiles is also known for high-end fantails and beautiful rainwater leopard gecko morph projects. Check out RazorSharpReptiles.com online and on Facebook. And if you're looking for quality food for your dubia roaches, crickets, mealworms, and superworms, look no further than MS2 Premium Insect Chow. Made with reptiles in mind, it contains no dog food, cat food, or chicken mash. Using only vegetable proteins and high-quality ingredients, MS2 Premium Insect Chow will have your feeders making a beeline for it. Contact MS2ENT.weebly.com, or it can also be purchased at Rainbow Mealworms and AB Dragons.
Okay, everybody, we are back. I just want to mention a couple things real quick before we get back into our discussion. Sea Serpents and Hotbox Incubators are one company now, and they are offering a special discount to Gecko Nation Radio listeners from tonight until Sunday the 22nd, I believe. You just check that real quick. Yep, Sunday the 22nd. So if you guys need a rack or an incubator of the highest quality, go to www.seaserpents.com. It's spelled C as in cat, SEPENTS.com. And also when you get there and you figure out what you want, email Chris at seaserpents.com and mention Gecko Nation Radio for the discount. The discount will be different on certain products based on pricing and whatnot, so you'll have to check exactly what it's going to be, but it's very gracious of him to do that for us. So definitely take advantage, guys. Also, I want to remind everyone that Gecko Nation Radio and Herpentine Radio are partners now as far as promoting each other. So definitely check out Herpentine Radio if you want more of a broader-based type of – my dog is coughing up a lung here broader-based herp discussions that basically cover all different types of topics. All right. So we left off before the break with basically – now, we have our females, we have the breeding down, we have our pairing down, and we basically want to go from here. Now, the next step in this process is going to be egg laying. So our females are fertilized. I'm going to start with Matt on this one. Once our females are fertilized, when do we start seeing good eggs or any eggs at that point?
I would say usually from anywhere from like 10 to 14 days typically is what I see after after I put the male in. And then it's usually, it can range anywhere from like 12 to 16 days after that is the next clutch, depending on the female, with the average being about 14 days.
Okay. And do you notice, I know some people have experienced the first clutches being duds. Marcia, do you have experience with that?
Oh, sure I do. I think that even with seasoned breeders, females, occasionally you'll get a first clutch of eggs that are not fertile. I think that it has to do with how long you wait between the time that you observe for, ovulation and the female is actually bred. Because sometimes that first set of ovum are past the point of fertilization, so they may develop into eggs that are not fertile. And it also is not uncommon for first-time breeder females. It can be two or three clutches sometimes before you'll get a fertile clutch of eggs.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's my experience is, I mean, and that's the, you know, the exception and not the rule that, you know, I've had some very healthy first-time females lay, you know, good fertile clutches right off the get-go and every 2 to 3 weeks after that. So I think it depends on the female how conditioned she is, and we've already talked about some of the ways that we condition our females for breeding. I mean, if they have good weight and they have good fat reserves, they're going to bounce back real well between clutches and, you know, but it's nothing to worry about if the first two and even sometimes three clutches that are laid are not viable eggs.
Okay. How about you, John? Would you like to answer that?
Yeah, I agree with everything said. I think it's just highly variable, and you really never know what's going to happen. Sometimes you can breed a female, and the first clutch comes out as duds, and then they start laying fertiles, or sometimes they keep laying infertiles, and no matter what you do, how many times you throw the male in there, it just never happens. So I think it just varies. You know, there's no way to completely predict it. There are averages, but It's so hard to predict that, you know. That's why you'll get one project, you'll have too many babies 1 year and not get anything from what you really wanted, and that's just the way it goes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Really, really variable.
Yeah, okay. Everybody, I'm going to open up the phone lines. So if you guys have a specific question related to breeding or incubation, this will be your chance to call in. Before we start talking about incubation, guys, I'll direct this question at Matt. Matt, suppose you have a female and she's laying great eggs, and you notice that she's starting to thin out and maybe not hold as much weight and you want to basically stop the egg production. Is there a way to do that? Is there a way to perhaps get her to stop laying eggs?
Yeah, when basically... Oh, sorry, sorry. Basically, when I only breed the, you know, put the male in once, and then once, you know, the basically all the sperm reserves are, you know, used up, basically she kind of stops on her own, and that kind of helps with, you know, having her not produce as many eggs as well, so she doesn't mm-hmm. get to that point.
Okay. Yeah, John, would you like to answer that?
No, it's pretty much exactly the same.
Okay, how about you, Marcia? Anything?
Well, okay. Remind me of what the question was, because I want to try to stay on topic because I have a tendency to wander off.
Okay, the question basically was like, say you have a female and she's been laying great eggs for you for the season. Maybe she's, you know, 3 or 4 clutches deep, and basically, you notice that she's not really holding her weight as well.
Okay. Yeah, she's not bouncing back between clutches or losing weight.
Yeah. Can you slow that egg production down?
Well,
anyway?
You know, I think that is something to be expected. I have very few females that at the end of their egging season weigh as much or look as good as they did at the beginning of the season. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I've got some great females that are just, you know, they're just ready, you know, they're just, you know, perfect breeder females. But as a general rule, the more clutches they lay and the more often they're laid, the less time that the female has to reset or catch up or bounce back between the clutches. To get them to stop, you know, the only thing that I can come up with would be cooling them. But on the flip side of that, if you cool them, then they're not going to eat, and you want them to eat. So it's a double-edged sword. I think that if you have a female that does not go into starting into breeding season in optimum health with you know, and I like to see my girls nice and fat. I mean, almost borderline overweight before season starts. And these are the ones that, not the males. I don't like them to be fat because I think it impedes on their ability to breed. But yeah, to get them to stop, I've had on occasion, and this also includes males. I've had males go off food during breeding season because they're so stressed out and all they want to do is breed. If that's the case, then I will actually remove them from especially the females from my you know little facility and put them somewhere else where they're not going to be smelling all of those pheromones, and I'll keep them kind of in a shady spot, and usually they'll shut down. But I can't lie to you. I have lost females over these last 18 years to laying eggs. I had one leopard gecko female. And now this is not common, but for a lot of the beginners out there that are just now, you know, experiencing breeding for the first time or thinking about it or whatever, it is not without its issues. But I had a female that laid 17 clutches of eggs in one season, and she died. She literally 17 clutches of eggs, and nothing I could do, nothing I could do would get her to stop laying eggs. And laying fertile eggs are just as strenuous as laying infertile eggs. So I did lose a female one time that she just literally wasted. And so I think at that point I was brokenhearted, of course, and you know, but it really does get you to start thinking and in focus and being more in tune with each of your animals. But just like Matt and John have both said, it really just depends on each individual gecko, and you have to know your geckos. You have to know what they tend to, what their tendencies are, and so. But I would say getting them out of a breeding environment where there are male and female pheromones raging in whatever, you know, area they are, and maybe keeping them a few degrees cooler and a little bit darker will kind of throw them into, okay, it's the end of breeding season. But you don't want to cool them completely because that will prevent them from eating, and that just adds to the, you know, the tragedy that is potential when it gets to that point.
Right. Okay. All right. We have some callers on the line. I'm going to take the one that's been on the longest here. Caller from the 347 area code, you are live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Boom.
Okay.
Wow.
Let me try that one.
That was interesting.
Yeah, let me try that one more time. Nope, we're not going to do that one. All right, caller from the 231 area code. You are live on Gecko Nation Radio. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, this is Josh.
Who?
Josh.
Okay, I can't hear you too good. Can you speak up a little bit?
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
A little better. Yep, go ahead. What's your question tonight?
I had a question about one of my females. Actually, after laying eggs, she did become very underweight. How would you actually recommend safely getting her back up to proper weight?
Okay, good question. I'm going to put you on hold. You can listen in, and we'll answer that question for you. Thanks for calling.
No problem.
All right, so we have a female. She's lost a lot of weight during her egg-laying season. What's the best way to get her boosted back up? I'll give this one to, let's see, who didn't we hear from in a while? John, I'll give this one to you, John, first.
Well, I think during the egg-laying season, that's one of the struggles you have, is that you got to always be feeding your females pretty much as possible. I'm really against overfeeding your geckos in general, but one time that you really do need to feed them a lot is when you have females that are laying eggs, because they need to have the vitamins and they need to have the calcium and they need to have the food and, you know, protein to build more eggs. You know, I mean, it's a lot of strain on a female.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've seen females, you know, females can go two clutches of eggs without really eating. But, I mean, if you take a healthy fat gecko and she lays two clutches of eggs without you having anything to eat, she's basically down to skin and bones after that. So you literally got to be on it, you know, make sure. When my females are laying eggs, I have a big bowl of roaches and superworms always available at that time. And I like to use superworms. I think it packs on a little bit more weight at a quicker time frame. And usually in the off season, I use roaches, you know, without the worms. But I just think just having the food always available at that time is important, you know, and especially having food that actually moves around. Sometimes if you throw mealworms in there, they'll kind of stop moving after a day or two. So if that's what you're feeding, then you need to make sure that you're on it every couple of days. But you know,
did any of you guys
if you have a problem with female, you know, throw some, you know, try some wax worms, you know, can help to build up weight. If you see one really going downhill and really skinny, you can hand feed. I like to hand feed freshly molted dubia. I think they're the best
hand feeding
bug there is. You know, just a really soft, freshly molted dubia, and there's pretty much nothing. You know, no gecko will deny that. So, I mean, with my, you know, like some of the geckos that I have to hand feed, like the Taylor Rye that I have, that's one of the only things I can get them to hand feed on, you know. So just using a really freshly molted dubia works good. Wax worms are okay. But, yeah, that's whatever you have to do to get the weight on.
And what about you, Matt? Do you have any tricks for that?
Putting weight back on females. I mean, basically, as long as they still have their feeding response, they're definitely still going to be
stable. Good point.
Once they lose that feeding response, then you're really behind the eight ball. I mean, I would say that in order of how easily they would take things, you're probably looking at crickets is probably the easiest. I would say lateralis is the next one, then dubia, supers, and millworms. Mm-hmm. So if what I would do is like start like at the, you know, millworms, superworms, try to get a meeting on those. If they want me on that, you need something that moves a little bit more. I would go to dubia. If they're not eating on the dubia, then kind of go to the lateralis or crickets. You know, and then kind of once they start eating on one, get a few meals into them, and then move back up the chain so that you're back to millworms again. And just because that's, you know, typically that's what most people use as their staple diet for their animals, and then kind of feed the other stuff as either treats, or, I mean, you know, some people like John will actually, you know, feed his like supers and the roaches all year round, which is definitely, you know, I would say that that's definitely a very good food source as well. For all year round, but the I would try crickets if the animal's not eating. Usually that'll kind of put some spunk into them, and the lateralis just because they move really quickly.
Okay, Marcia, do you have anything to add?
All right, am I online? Or, I mean, on
you
on
are.
Air? Okay, good.
Yes, you are.
Well,
on the air the whole show.
Oh. All right. Well, sometimes I put it on mute, and I can't remember if I'm muted or not muted. But I probably need to be muted more often. But sorry. But anyway, yeah, I agree with both Matt and John. But mm-hmm. you know, there's always that percentage of females that. Okay, let me stop and backtrack. Generally speaking, the females will go off of food for several days before they lay their eggs. That's very common, and actually that's a flag that goes up and says that they're getting ready to lay their eggs. That and, you know, incessantly digging in their lay box. But generally after they've laid their eggs and within 24 hours, they are ravenous. They are so hungry that they just, you can just see them like vibrating with excitement to, you know, to eat. Because they've been off food and they just laid a clutch of eggs, which has pretty much depleted their body of protein for the yolk and calcium for the shell. They're hungry, but sometimes there are females that just that's it. They lay a clutch of eggs, and no matter what you do, they don't want to eat.
What about pinky mice, Marshall?
Well, and that, I was just, thank you for mentioning that, David, because I have used pinky mice, especially the smallest you can find, in some cases to, the main thing is not really what you're feeding them, it's what you can do to get them to eat, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to, you know, granted, it's kind of a difficult thing if you start feeding them wax worms. They do get spoiled. They flat do. But you know what? If you've got an animal, especially a female, who's in jeopardy, whose health is compromised, it doesn't matter what you feed them. You just need to get nutrition in them and hopefully get their feeding response back up again. And I agree with what John and Matt said about something that moves around. I mean, you know, any gecko can belly up to a bowl, right? I mean, there's a bowl full of stuff, and they can belly up to it and just sit there and eat, okay? But I think that something that moves around like a cricket or lateralis or even a dubia, because they're pretty fast too, will catch their eye. And what you want to do is reinstill their feeding response, but there are times that just doesn't happen either. It just doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the times when you start worrying. Because then usually by that time, they're 2 weeks into their next clutch they're going to lay. And I think that these are some things that novices don't really appreciate or understand. And I'm not saying that anybody's stupid or anything like that. I'm just saying that there is just so much more to breeding than you think there is. It's not just throwing two animals together and, you know, having these eggs. It is not. Breeding geckos is not without its issues. And getting these, keeping these females healthy through the breeding season, to me, is more important than how many fertile eggs I've got or how many eggs hatch.
Right.
Seriously. But that's just me. I do use my slurry on occasion when I think that there's a gecko that is, you know, borderline leaning back and forth between, you know, life and death. I'll intervene. I'll do whatever I need to do. But for me, the best thing, and I'll repeat what I said earlier in the show, is to remove them, get them out of that room.
Mm-hmm.
Get them out.
Yep.
They don't need to smell the males. They don't need to smell all the ovulating females. They're in a in a place where, you know, there aren't any smells other than her own. You might want to adjust the, you know, the lighting. If they're got some weight on them, then you do want to semi-cool them. But you know what? That could kill them, too,
mm-hmm.
by trying to simulate cooling on a female who's, you know, health is compromised. It will kill her. Okay?
I hope this doesn't happen to too many new people, because it can definitely discourage people from ever breeding again if they have this kind of a first experience.
Well, I hope I'm not being discouraging.
No, but I mean,
don't
it happens.
To be
I mean,
discouraging. But
yeah,
I'm going to straight up tell people that this is the side of breeding geckos that doesn't always get discussed or talked about, and it certainly is something that you need to understand, be aware of before you start breeding your animals, that this could happen. And of course, the more animals you have, the more chances you're going to have of something like this happening.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, it boils down to making sure, like what we talked about in the first hour of this show is, you know, making sure that your females are old enough, that they have enough weight on them and a good fat reserve in their tail, and that they're, you know, ready to breed, because chances are those females will get through the breeding season just fine. It is it is expected for them to lose weight. They are going to lose weight. And usually once they lay their eggs, they're hungry. But if there's that one in 100 that just doesn't want to thrive, you
know.
And it could
be a genetics thing too, right, Marcia?
It's very possible. Matt's more of the genetics guy than I am. I'm more of the intuitive been doing this for 18 years kind of person, where Matt and John both are probably more capable and of answering genetics type tendency questions.
Okay. Well, we got a bunch of callers on the line, so I want to spend the last or the next half hour of the show. You guys, we can do this show for as long as you guys want. I think we should cover the incubation part now and go from there. Let's take one more call, though. We have callers on the line. I have a bunch of them here. I'm going to take, let's see, who's been on the longest? Caller from the 816 area code. You are live on Gecko Nation Radio. Caller, are you there? Okay, we'll take the next one. The caller from 570, I think this is a listener, but I'm going to take your call. Let's see. 570, you're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hi, guys.
Hey,
it's Amanda.
How are you?
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, I am awesome.
Hold on one second, everyone. I have a quick question. Does anybody get the name of the first caller by any chance? Did you hear what their name was? I couldn't tell. I couldn't hear it clearly.
No, I don't.
No,
you
know what? I didn't either.
Okay. No big deal. I got their number written down. Go ahead, Marcy. I mean, Mandy. Thinking of Marcy from MS2.
I am actually cleaning my bins right now, listening to the show. So,
good thing to do while you're doing cleaning.
Yeah, getting some new calcium in for my girls. But I actually had a question about incubation. When it comes time to decide what temperature to put them at, what sort of things do you consider in deciding whether you're going to make the boys or the girls? What do you consider when deciding what for ratios you want to have?
Okay.
That's a question. I don't know how many boys and girls I should make.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Okay. John, why don't you take this one?
Well, it is a good question, and it does vary quite a bit. For the most part, you're going to probably want to produce more females, as those are probably going to be easier to sell for a lot of people. You know, people can keep them in groups. Typically, people want more females than they do males if they're doing breeding as well. So as a general rule, breeding more for females is usually the goal. There's certain projects where, in my particular incubation, the way I incubate, if I incubate for a female, it's pretty much 99% sure it's going to be a female. But if I incubate for a male, it's probably 80 to 90% going to be a male. So it's not as great of odds. So I kind of keep that in mind as well when I'm incubating. But there's certain projects where, you know, that you're trying to genetically test something out where you need to produce a bunch of females and to breed back to the father, maybe to test something out. That could be a case where you incubate all for female. Sometimes some years I produce a lot of one way or the other. Maybe I'll produce too many males, or, you know, for instance, this year I didn't mean to do this, but I produced a lot of Afghans, but I only produced one male this entire year. And,
that's
wasn't
common.
The plan. Yeah. I mean, last year I produced a ton of them, and, you know, I know I incubated more for male. I keep a card on every tub, so I know that I incubated more for male. So maybe the ones I incubated for male, and, you know, maybe they died in the egg. That could be the case, or maybe, you know, for whatever reason they didn't hatch. I know the first one that came out male, and the sibling came out female. And then the next group of males that I had that was growing up ended up being two females. So all of a sudden I had a ratio that ended up being pretty much all females for the year, which is unfortunate because when I sell these, I usually sell them. Most people want a pair or they want a trio or something like that. So so next year I'll probably incubate more for male. So that's maybe a decision, you know, that I'll go in the future with, you know. And you do that a lot. There'll be certain projects where you're going to get really male or female heavy one year before, and you might want to switch that up. Sometimes you're trying to hit that one gecko that's going to give you the gecko that you want for the next year. You know, I was trying to get a white and yellow raptor this year, and I had a white and yellow eclipse het raptor male, and I had some raptor females and some other stuff. But, you know, with the odds and everything, I incubated a lot for male, probably more than I would. But I wanted to get that one gecko that, you know, I could use in the future rather than having to use in hets anymore. So there's a lot of deciding factors. That's the whole fun of planning it out and the projects that you breed. I keep a notepad in my phone, and anytime I think of something that I want to breed or create, or I get an idea for breeding, because sometimes when you get a female that ovulates and you're putting males together, maybe you're not coming up with the best idea for that pairing. You know, you kind of come up with it on the spot. So I'll actually put notes in my phone, you know, of what I want to create or what I want to pair up with. And I'll be sitting there cleaning 100 cages or, you know, a couple hundred cages or tubs, and kind of get this enlightenment, like, idea that I'm going to do this or that. You know, maybe it gets spawned from, like, seeing a baby that's cool or something. You know, there's all these ideas that pop in your head out of nowhere. And the more you live and breathe this stuff, it, you know, becomes your life. You literally are dreaming about it and all kinds of stuff. So
when you get those ideas, it's good to put it down on either a notepad or, you know, in my case, my phone. I put a note in my phone, and that's a good way to keep notes on breeding or what you want to do. So that way, I look back at that notepad, so by the time it's breeding season, I already know, like, I really have a good idea of, like, some of the ideas that I came up with. And the possibilities are pretty much endless, so. But, you know, that also affects what, you know, what females you have to breed and what males you have to breed as adults. You might have a really awesome raptor male or something that you have at your in your collection, for instance, and maybe you want to produce a lot of females to go with them. You might want to do that, you know. Or if you don't have a really nice male, you might want to incubate all for male for that one gecko that's going to really put your projects, you know, over the top. I think half of it's partly sales and what you're going to be able to sell for the next year, and then also half of it's what you need for your own projects.
Right.
Going forward. So.
Right.
Okay.
Thank
you. All right, cool, Mandy. Does that answer your question?
Yes. I actually had another incubation question if I have time, but.
Yeah, go ahead, and then I'll take the next caller.
Okay. I actually had another question with, I have a lot of albinos, and trying to incubate at a higher temperature for more brightly colored females, I was wondering the best way to go about doing that in, like, starting them out for the first so many weeks, incubated for female, and then raising the temperatures. I didn't know in what, like, how quickly do you raise the temperature? What's the process in doing that to safely not, like, kill the eggs in such a quick, you know what I mean? Not
okay.
Killing them.
We're definitely going to,
like,
that's definitely a topic for tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Mandy, that's definitely a topic for tonight, and we're going to get right into that. I just want to take this other call because he's been on hold for a long time. And
okay.
I'll make sure.
Awesome.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, go ahead, John. What's up?
The first caller just messaged me on Facebook. His name's Joshua.
Josh. Okay, cool.
Okay.
All right. All right, Mandy. I'll let you go. Thanks for your questions.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Mandy.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Chris. Here you are. You've been on a while. You're live on Gecko Nation Radio.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm good.
What's your question tonight?
First of all, hi, Marcia. So me.
Krista!
Hi!
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
No, wait.
Krista,
you guys know
works,
each other, it seems.
Well, Krista works with me.
Oh, okay.
Krista is a paid employee. Not, I'm just kidding.
Oh, we've heard about her when she comes and helps you when you go away, right?
Oh, I wouldn't be able to go away if it weren't for her. Yes, you're right. This is Krista, but I don't want to storm your parade here. So
it's okay.
I'll shut up.
No, that's okay.
No, it's okay. Recently branched off though, and so that's my question. Is this is my first year breeding away from Marcia. And I have two females currently that decided that it's breeding season already. And one of them is one of Marcia's proven breeders that I got off of her. And she was off food for a good amount of time, and then she finally laid a slug. So Marcia said that I should put a male in with her. And after keeping a male in with her twice for 4 days each, I separated them. She's still not eating, and I don't even see follicles anymore. And I was wondering what I could do to possibly encourage her to either eat or I'm not even sure, to be honest, that they locked up either time that they were put together.
Okay.
So, okay, is this a question for me or for the other two reputable
Go
breeders
ahead, Marcia.
At least?
In general, I mean, Marcia,
well,
you know.
Well, I know the female she's talking about, and she doesn't miss many meals.
And she's missed a lot. She's gone down from probably 78, 80 grams down to about 65 to 70.
And she still has not produced viable eggs or
I don't, I currently don't even see any follicles.
Any follicles?
No, and she's still not eating, and I do not think that she has locked up with my male either time.
Hmm.
She's got a few little battle wounds on her tail, which means that he definitely tried, but, you know, not to sound weird, but as harpers, you know, it's kind of what we do. I've sat and watched for hours at a time, and nothing happens. She avoids him at all costs. And so now I'm just getting concerned. You were talking earlier about possibly just separating her from back altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something I should start thinking about doing?
Well, okay, this is kind of a closed conversation because the rest of the listeners and the other two breeders aren't savvy to the history of this particular female.
But in case it happens to anybody else, I mean,
regardless.
Well,
exactly. No, it's definitely something worthwhile talking about. Okay, this gal, she's one of the kind of geckos that just gets fat like Jabba the Hutt before breeding season. I mean, she doesn't get fed any more or less than anybody else, but
no.
She is, you know, she's huge. She just gets huge. But the thing is that if she's lost, in my opinion, if a gecko loses a minimum of 10% of their body weight, then I put a tag on their, on their tub. You know what I do, Krista. But the thing is that if she's laying slugs, there's just as much taxation on her system, her body, and everything else laying slugs as there is, you know, fertile eggs. So the problem is getting her to lay fertile eggs. And if she's not receptive to breeding...
She's only laid that one slug.
That's it. Okay.
One.
And you don't see any ovulation at all?
No. And, you know, I know I've had trouble in the past identifying it, but another one of my females is very clearly ovulating, so I know what I'm looking for.
Yeah, you've seen enough ovulation over here at Golden Gate Geckos to know what to look for. So, you know what? In a case like this, I would probably separate her.
Okay.
She's not a young breeder anymore, although she is perfectly capable of laying really, you know, beautiful clutches. She's not a second or third year breeder. So if you can, get her away from the male, bump up her heat a little bit. If you can manipulate the light to be more than 12 hours than the dark, hopefully, you know, she'll be, you know, interested in food.
Because I've offered her just about anything. Mealworms, waxworms, superworms, dubia, pinkies, baby food. In food.
Yeah.
Any of my last resorts, and she's not interested in anything.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Krista. I mean, I would separate her from the male or in the proximity of the male or any other ovulating females. And then I'll tell you what, why don't you and I talk about this offline here, and
okay.
We'll see if we can't come up with a plan.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any information that I could give other listeners that would, you know, that would be viable. But you know me, I'm willing to try a lot of different unorthodox type things. I'm not saying that they're harmful in any way, but if we need to just...
Well, let me just jump in for a second here. Marsha, let me jump in for a second.
Sure.
You know, this is a good...
Please.
This is actually a good example of how... There's always going to be these very specific type of situations that are going to arise for breeders, and
they're going to be
unique. And you know, we can give you as much information tonight as possible on, you know, basically, you know, how things would go in an ideal way. But these geckos will throw you for a loop. I definitely want to hit on the question that Mandy brought up about the incubation. So let's move to that, but
okay, Krista. Let's talk.
Thank you.
And it's not saying that, you know, what this discussion is not going to be worthwhile for other listeners? Because I think it would be. I think it would be a
good topic of discussion. I totally understand. But, yeah, I mean, just the fact that you guys touched on even just removing her from the
mm-hmm.
rack from not only the male but the other ovulating female.
Yes.
I mean, that's helpful to me in and of itself.
It's all
awesome.
About the pheromones, girlfriend.
But well, thank you guys for having
I'm not
me
dissing
on.
You. Krista, I'm not dissing you at
no,
all.
At
you
all.
Know that I'm not. And so...
I'm not offended.
No, I know you're not, but we've only got like 15 or 20 minutes left of the show, so...
That's fine. Thank you guys for having me on, actually. I'm really excited.
All right, Chris. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you got on, Krista, honey. We'll talk, okay?
Okay.
All right, sweetheart.
All right. And you know what? This is a perfect example of when you buy an animal from a breeder, make sure you're buying it from someone that is respectable, that will... take the time to help you with these very specific things.
Listen,
and,
David, you're right. You nobody's going to get from Petco or PetSmart, and you can like bleep me out for saying those two names.
But you're not going to get
from them that you're going to get from a breeder like John or Matt or myself. As far as the one-on-one, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
And this question I'm going to let Matt tackle because. I think you've got a lot of experience with this particular topic. Matt, Mandy brought up a really good point about incubation and temperatures, and I believe it was Ron Tremper that discovered if you want to make really colorful albino females, that it's not always a good idea to incubate them for the entire 90 days or whatever it is, whatever a lot of people do, in a lower temp. You want to do a specific type of special type of incubation process. Would you mind going into that for us?
Matt, I'm going to butt in and then I'm going to shut up, I promise.
Okay.
No, it was not Ron Tremper who came up with that method of incubation.
Okay.
Absolutely not. It was not Ron Tremper. It was the labs of David Cruz in Texas at Texas A&M. And if anybody would like to email me, I can provide all the links necessary that they are the ones that did the study. Ron borrowed it. And
All right.
I'm shutting up now.
Go ahead, Matt.
All right. Well, first off, you're not really messing with the color per se. You're definitely messing with the dark pigmentation and the white pigmentation, but you're not messing with like the orange or anything like that. So any of the orange coloration is not going to be affected by the change in or the different temperature incubation. Let's put it that way. Basically, anything on an albino, and actually just in the Tremper albino, that you see as being as a baby is white or is like see-through, that is the areas on the animal that can be affected by the different temperature incubations. Whenever it's incubated at a darker temperature, those areas will be a darker color, basically. So it really does not affect the color of, like say a super hypo tangerine or any other line bred animal. It is literally just the, how much brown pigmentation will be on a Tremper albino. I really haven't even seen it in bells or rainwaters that much either. So I don't even group those guys in the same category. It's typically just on the Tremper albino. As far as, time frames, stuff like that, it's definitely one of those things that it's in the last couple weeks of incubation. That's whenever all the color is actually, pretty much produced in the animal. The sex is determined, they say within the first 14 days, but just to be sure, I would keep them in there for like 21 days. And then really what I've done in the past is we'll start off at like an 80-degree incubator and go up about 2 degrees every week, basically. Sometimes it's a little bit quicker, sometimes it's a little bit longer. Basically what I do is I just snake them through a bunch of ovipositor incubators, and whenever they get to the last ones is usually whenever they hatch. But that also depends on, you know, where I'm at in the breeding season and stuff like that. If it's very beginning of the breeding season, you know, some might only get to the, you know, 85, 86 degree incubator because there's just not enough eggs behind them to move them along. But mm-hmm. with that being said, usually as long as they're incubated above, I would say like 85, 86, they're not going to have much of that dark pigmentation anyway. Typically, whenever you see the dark pigmentation on the albinos, it's whenever they are incubated at like around like 80, 82 degrees. Because even at like 83, 84, you're still not going to see that much dark pigmentation. And it's not just during the egg incubation when you can get that dark pigmentation. It's also after the animal is hatched as well. And that's one of those things a lot of people don't, you know, either don't know or don't understand as well. If the bottom of your rack is cooler than the top of your rack, the albinos in the bottom would actually be a darker color. Pigmentation would come out more than if they were in the top of the rack. And that's just by basically being kept at a slightly lower temperature as well. So that's also another very important thing that if you are breeding like Tremper albinos, to keep the babies warm as well, because once the babies get a little bit cool, it can actually darken them up, and then that dark color will actually stay forever. Sometimes people like that little bit of darker pigmentation to them. I've actually seen some people actually market them as something totally different, but at the end of the day, they're just Tremper albino, just the low incubation Tremper, basically. Or a dookie, some people call them, or like, you know, a brown Tremper, or, you know, whatever. But
chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate as well. That's another one. But it's at the end of the day, it's still a Tremper albino. And it's one of those things that if you hatch babies out of it and they hatch out of a higher incubation, you're not going to have chocolates anymore. You're going to have white chocolate. That's basically what you're going to have. So,
okay.
And so, but I mean, just to reiterate, does not have an effect on, you know, like line bird things like tangerine, carrot tail, carrot head. It does not have effect on any of that stuff. There are a lot of people that say that, you know, people cook for color and stuff like that, and it's, you can't cook for color. That's just pure genetic. You know,
it is now. Yeah, he's right.
It's one of those things where, you know, there's certain colors in animals that can be manipulated by the low incubation temps or the temperature at which you're keeping the animal, and that's usually the melanin. So, you know, anything that produces like orange or yellow pigmentation has nothing to do with the melanin. And the melanin
because albinos do not have melanin in their skin, so it doesn't apply to, you know, the albinos.
So then, what exactly is happening then when they do brown out or get that chocolate look? If it's not actual melanin that's taking over, is it like, what would you call it?
It's pigment. There's a difference between pigment and melanin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I think that's what Matt's trying to get at. Is true, mm-hmm. Matt? I mean, isn't that what you're trying to say, is that it's not a matter of, you know, the intrinsic color or value of the animal that is affected, as much as it is the darker pigment. But there's a difference between pigment and melanin.
What do you have to say about this, John?
I pretty much agree with what Matt's saying about it. I don't think, mm-hmm. I think the actual, just the dark pigment's really what's affected. Because anytime you see a gecko that's kept really cold, you'll see like the darker parts, those black spots and stuff, they usually get darker first. So, I mean, that kind of gives you a hint to what's really going to, you know, be darker on the animal from actually color temps or from the temperature. So, I mean, I pretty much agree the same thing. I think Tremper albino definitely gets affected more than anything.
Okay. The show is, we're getting to the end of the show, and there's one last thing that I definitely want to touch on for all the new people out there that don't know. And I'll give this one. I'll let this one go with you, John. The very basics about incubation. Males and females. What are the temperatures? Now, leopard geckos are temperature sex determined. That means that you can actually incubate your eggs for males or females, depending on the temperature. John, what are the temperatures that are good for males, and what are the temperatures that will produce mostly females?
Well, as Matt said, there's usually the first 14 days of incubation is what determines the actual sex of the gecko. So, you know, as he said, too, it's a good measure to incubate for 21 days at that temperature, just to be sure. As far as females go, I mean, even as low as 76 up to like 82 is pretty much always going to be female. Even 83 is typically going to be female. And as you go up higher, the 85 to 87 range, you're going to start getting more of a mix, like 50-50. Above that, usually like 89 to like 92 is going to be pretty much all male. Above 92, you actually go back to females again, which are called hot females.
If you don't experience mortality at that point, yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. If it doesn't, you know, go too far. And the same thing, you know, hot females and even low females are typically known to have, you know, lower fertility rates. So it's usually best not to go that low or that high. What I do, I don't think many people actually do this or if anybody even does this, but I start everybody off. I start females off at about 80, and then I gradually move them up just like Matt does. Over time I actually move them through incubators. In total, I have like 7 incubators, I believe. So I move them through until they reach the final incubator, which I hatch them out of. It's roughly about 85.5 or 86 degrees. And then I actually do the opposite with males. I start them off at about 90, and I keep them in an incubator that actually fluctuates about 2 degrees a day. So they go from like 90.5 down to like 89 at night. So they actually have a little fluctuation during the day. And then they go down to the next incubator low, which is usually about 87. And then they actually, all my geckos hatch out on the same incubator. So males and females end up hatching out of like the incubator that's about 85.5 or 86. And the reason I do this, I see a lot of males, if I incubate them the whole time at 90 degrees, by the way, if you incubate them at a higher temperature, they hatch faster. So, you know, you can actually incubate for a male, and you can hatch them out in, you know, 33 days or so. And if you incubate them at lower temperatures, they can go for a much longer period. So what happens when you hatch them that quick is a lot of the males will develop too quickly, and they'll actually have what's called thermal stress, and they'll have problems. They could actually have deformities, or they can hatch out really small. So I like to incubate them to start off with to just lock in their sex, and then I actually drop them down to let them slow down a little bit. You don't want to do it too quick, so again, make sure you do it in increments where you drop them down a little bit at a time. But I find that, you know, adding a little bit more time to their incubation period by dropping them down a little bit, it decreases the deformities, and the babies hatch out a little stronger. A lot of them get out of the egg easier. You know, a lot of eggs, actually you lose a lot of eggs because they can't get out of the actual shell itself. So some of that can be, you know, a little bit too moist on the incubation medium, but also if they're weak and they're too small and they're trying to get out, you know, sometimes that can do it too. But yeah, that's basically what I do. And then it also makes it easy for me because I basically only look in one incubator at the very end, and that's all I pull eggs out of at the very end, or that's all I pull babies out at the very end. So I only have to look in one. But
It's just a different method. I mean, other ways work, but that's the way I've been doing it.
Okay. All right, cool. All right, well, we're not going to go all night tonight. I think we did an awesome job basically laying out the groundwork for anybody that's looking to get into leopard gecko breeding, short of actually buying a good leopard gecko handbook. And I swear behind, swear on Ron Tremper's first book and his new book, Leopard Geckos, the Next Generations. If you're a beginner, it's essential that you research these important things that you're going to need to know in order to properly breed and care for leopard geckos and any other species of animal, for that matter. Find a good book. There's no substitute for that. I'd like to give each one of you guys an opportunity to have some closing remarks, and let's start with Marcia, and then we'll go to John and Matt.
Am I on the air?
You've been on all night, Marcia.
Okay, so I guess I'm not on mute.
Nope.
My poor brain. First of all, I want to thank you very much for providing this time for people to learn and listen in, and I think it's imperative, and I just want to give you a big old hug for you know, providing this opportunity for us to talk. And I also want to thank, you know, Matt and John, whom I, you know, dearly respect. And I just think it's important that all of us have something to contribute. And for those of you listening in, thank you. And the questions were really good, and I know that 2 hours isn't enough time to cover everything, but I just want to, you know, express my gratitude for everybody involved for participating in this. So that's my closing comment.
Okay. Go ahead, John.
I'll just keep it brief. Just thanks to everyone that's listening, and thanks Dave and Marcia and Matt. You know, I appreciate the chance to be on here, and it's always fun. I think it's always important to get out some of this information. You know, it saves me a little time when I'm answering questions. Sometimes I can just refer people to the radio show, which, you know, it's nice with a busy schedule, so. And I think they get a little bit more information this way, too, rather than trying to type a 20-word comment, you know, and try to plug it all in there. So, anyway, yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it. And
cool.
Everybody have a good night.
All right. How about you, Matt?
Yeah, I think they touched on everything. You know, I wish everybody the best. And, you know, good luck with everybody out there with your, you know, trying to breed leopard geckos and stuff like that. And, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay, cool. All right, thank you very much, Marcia, John, and Matt, for coming
on.
My
pleasure,
really,
David. Thank you.
Yeah, and Marcia, you're going to be interviewing me soon in a few weeks.
I am. We need to, like, lock our heads together and figure out what you're willing to divulge and what you're not, because I might ask some questions that you're not prepared to answer.
You can hit me with whatever you want.
Yeah, but you know what? I think it's really important, and I think all the listeners out there would love to know more about you, David.
I know. And
really?
That's what we're going to do. It'll be fun.
It'll be a lot of fun.
All right.
It will. All right.
Cool.
Good night, everybody, and thank you so much for listening in and participating. And I don't know. Everybody's just great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to let my guests go. I'm going to play the outro, and then I'll be back with my closing remarks. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
Gecko Nation Radio is a David Fine Gecko's creation and production. You can visit the show's Facebook page at Gecko Nation Radio. I also have a great family-friendly group on Facebook called Gecko Nation. Apply for membership today. The jazz music you heard tonight was generously donated and created by Jeremy Turgeon of J&D Reptiles. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for the great musical pieces. You can check out Jeremy at J&D Reptiles on YouTube and on Facebook. And a very special thank you to our news anchor, graphic designer, and audio tech, Steve Barker. All the graphics, audio sponsor plugs, and music overlays were assembled by Steve. Check out Steve on YouTube at BC Barker Creations. He has some terrific videos for the herp community with amazing geckos and snakes. Please support the U.S. Herpetocultural Alliance. They are our most effective defense against legislation that threatens our rights of exotic animal ownership. Sign up for their newsletter and donate if you can at usherp.org.
Okay, everybody. Excellent episode tonight. I am so happy with all the information and the way we were able to get it out so effectively. As we said during the show, there's no substitute for a good handbook and buying from a respectable breeder that's going to be able to handle individual issues that come up. Now, keep in mind, animals are unpredictable, and you could do everything 100% perfect and still have an issue arise. That's where having that good breeder to turn to is of the utmost importance. I also want to let everyone know that Gecko Nation Radio is also totally behind USARC, and I'm going to be adding that to our outro plug soon for the next episode, hopefully. And I'm still going to support Herp Alliance and PJAC, and I think our most direct route to our goal of protecting our rights is to support all of these organizations and to let go of any hard feelings that anyone has towards one or the other. All the nonsense about those types of things has to stop, and we need to unify, okay? The old grudges are not even valid anymore. So most people don't even remember what they were about. So let's get together, everyone, and let's win this so we don't lose our animals. I think that's just about it. I think the last thing that I want to say before I end the show is this. Later, everybody.